We don't have a lot of time, unfortunately, but we do have some time. And I sometimes think that Administrator Pruitt has the toughest job in Washington, so I don't envy you.
We should.
But the one thing I can be sure of is that you're not bored. So my first question about to the Administrator of EPA is, what do you view today as your biggest challenge or your biggest frustration in trying to carry out your obligations?
I think we may have to share a mic for a second, Boyden, and it's good to see you. And we do have exciting things going on at the EPA. And to your question, a lot of work that we're engaged in as far as regulatory reform, and I think sometimes that's misinterpreted as deregulation. There is a difference between the steps we're taking at the EPA and what traditionally has been viewed as deregulation. We're actually providing regulatory clarity with respect to previous decisions made by the past administration in areas like WOTUS and CPP, which we'll get into a little bit. But all that being said, I think probably one of the greatest challenges we have is simply trying to reorient thinking, because there's been an attitude adopted over the last several years that as a country, we have to choose. We have to choose between protecting or being a good steward of our environment and jobs and growth. And I just think that's a false narrative. In fact, if you look at this country historically, and Boyden, you know this very, very well, we've reduced those pollutants that we regulate under the Clean Air Act since 1980 by over 65%. And we've also grown our GDP rather substantially as well. This is a little bit of an example of what we deal with, Boyden. Because frankly, is that a thoughtful dialogue? I mean, that's not a thoughtful discussion about these issues. And frankly, what's so controversial about reforming Superfund sites? Leonard, I think these folks need to join the Federalist Society. Because at the Federalist Society, we actually believe in rule of law. We actually believe in taking a statute and administering it in the executive branch consistent with Congress's intent. We don't believe in making it up as we go, as we did with WOTUS and CPP, creating uncertainty in the marketplace. And frankly, Boyden, as I've indicated, we believe at the agency and across the country that we can be about growth and protecting the environment. So we need to reorient thinking, I think, has been demonstrated here today so far.
Two of your biggest policy challenges that you're engaging in now is to write up, define the waters of the United States, sometimes known as the WOTUS rule, which is based on an old statute involving the navigable waters of the United States, which somehow have been turned into prairie potholes, which has always been a puzzle to me. And also the Clean Power Plan, which as many of you may know, is the only plan to have been stayed in at the appellate court level by the Supreme Court. And you led the fight. Maybe you could flesh out a little bit more what you plan to do with these two.
Well, it's interesting.
To the extent that you can.
It's interesting you mentioned prairie potholes. I thought potholes were those things we drove over on the road and across various parts of the country. But I was in North Dakota not too long ago and actually saw a prairie pothole. And you're exactly right, Boyden. The past administration took the Clean Water Act and reimagined authority, actually took the definition, the term, water of the United States, and stretched it so far as to strain credibility with puddles and dry creek beds and ephemeral drainage ditches. In fact, I was in Salt Lake City, Utah, back in early to mid-August, and I was with the governor and a member of the Army Corps of Engineers, and we were looking at a subdivision that was being built there in Salt Lake City. And this individual looked at the subdivision and he said, Scott, He was pointing to an ephemeral drainage ditch that was part of the subdivision being built. And he said, Scott, that's a water of the United States. And I said, well, it's not going to be anymore. And and the reason it's not going to be is because Congress never intended, as the Clean Water Act was adopted, to take things like an ephemeral drainage ditch, a dry creek bed, characteristics that lack navigability, waterways that lack navigability concerns, and turn that into a water of the United States. And so this is all about regulatory clarity. It was frankly about jurisdiction, about power, about land use decisions being made in Washington, D.C., as opposed to private property owners across the country. So many think that this is just a farming and ranching issue. It really affects all land use decisions. And so we're providing regulatory clarity there, two-step process, actually. We're withdrawing the deficient rule from 2015. That process is ongoing. In fact, it's almost complete. And then we'll have a substitute definition sometime in 2018. And that definition will hew to the case law and the text, and I believe the intent and purpose behind the Clean Water Act with respect to what a water of the United States is going forward, and to recognize there's a very important role that states play with respect to regulation of water. That's a partnership, and I think that's one of the things that's missed as we look at environmental regulation today. Congress was very prescriptive at the beginning in the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, at ensuring states had a voice, had a role, participation, because, as I indicated, in Utah, second most dry state in the country, the very next day I was in Minnesota. The issues in Minnesota are much different than they are in Utah. And so Congress recognized the importance of bringing states along in regulation to ensure that you dealt with the particular issues of that state and the needs of the community. So we're going to recognize federalism, and that's one of the things I've emphasized during my time at the agency. Rule of law is the focus, process, and federalism principles are driving everything that we do to ensure good outcomes for the environment.
One of the changes that you have addressed is the old problem of what those of us who have worked in your world, sue and settle, which allows an NGO, an environmental group, to go in with a friendly lawsuit, get a court decree, which then authorizes you to do things the statute never authorized, or the statutes. Can you go into that a little bit?
Yeah, I think it's a problem. You know, regulation through litigation is something that has been utilized at the EPA. I don't think it's just particular to the EPA. I think it's across various agencies of the federal government. It's happened with DOI as well. I issued a memo, a directive a couple weeks ago that really built on General Meese's memo from the 1980s dealing with sue and settle principles. And we instructed the agency that the days of walking into a court where a third party sues the agency and there's a negotiation that occurs that is substantive in nature, substantive rulemaking, a discretionary duty that becomes a non-discretionary duty, or a timeline that's changed, or some kind of substantive obligation is in, you know, cabined within that consent decree, and then using that to regulate across the country, those days are over. And I issued that memo to the entire agency and provided certain steps that we're going to take to ensure that those days are over, as an example. We're going to post, if there's settlement discussions that are ongoing between the agency and a third party, we're going to post the settlement agreement online and take comment for at least 30 days with respect to those discussions. We want people to be aware of that. If a state has an interest and they seek to intervene in a proceeding, the agency historically has tried to fight state intervention in cases that actually impact them. Several years ago, there was a Clean Air Act case involving regional haze. North Dakota discovered negotiations that were ongoing in California in a case, tried to intervene in that case to make sure that due process was served. Both EPA and Justice fought it at that time. A consent decree was entered into, and literally the consent decree was taken to North Dakota and said, thou shall, and use that to regulate and to basically direct North Dakota to take steps under the Clean Air Act as they considered their state implementation plan for regional haze. That's wrong. And so we want to encourage states' voice in that process. After all, let me share something with you. When I came into this position, there were over 700 state implementation plans that were sitting on a shelf at the EPA. 700 states had invested time and money and resources to advance air quality, and they literally were in our office waiting to be acted upon with no sense of urgency. That's just simply a bad message to states and folks across the country that we want to see good outcomes for air quality. And so we're addressing that along with this sue and settle approach as well. And hopefully other agencies across the federal government will take those steps as well to discourage this type of practice of regulation through litigation.
So you mentioned state implementation plans, which may be a mystery to some of you in the audience. That's how, in this federalist structure of the Clean Air Act, the national standards for air quality get implemented by the states, which is where the implementation takes place. You have said that you would really like to see every state or every county in attainment for the various violations that still exist. Could you go into that in a little more detail? Because I think that is really important.
Well, think about it. I mean, the past administration, when they left office, 40% of this country lived in areas that didn't meet their air quality standards, about 120 million people. And states, as I indicated, in many instances had submitted plans to our agency to improve air quality, 700-plus state implementation plans. Why wouldn't an agency act with diligence, attention, focus, to partner with governors and DEQs across the country to address those air quality standards that are unique to those particular areas? It just makes abundant sense, and it just wasn't happening. And that's one of the things I want to emphasize to you, that one of the most striking things that I've seen as I've arrived at the agency and we're leading with these changes is the lack of urgency in areas that you would consider most basic and most fundamental. You know, the Superfund program. It's non-delegable under the statute. The EPA is directly responsible for cleanup and remediation with respect to Superfund sites. We have over 1,330 of those sites across the country. Many of the sites have been on the list for decades. To give you an example, there's a site in Westlake, Missouri, just outside of St. Louis. 8,000 tons of uranium from the Manhattan Project commingled with 38,000 tons of solid waste, buried about 80 feet deep across this large geographical area, discovered in 1970, listed in 1990. And as we're in this room today, 27 years after being listed on the national priority list, the agency still has not made a decision on how to remediate that site, excavate or cap, not clean it up, not fix the problem, but just simply decide. And I would love to say to you that that's an isolated example, but there are examples across the entire portfolio with respect to Superfund. So whether it's water infrastructure or state implementation plans on air quality or Superfund initiatives with respect to remediating land waste across this country, we have so much opportunity to do good work for the American people, to work together with governors and citizens to achieve good outcomes. These issues don't have to be as divisive as they are. We can really, truly achieve good things and do it the right way.
My understanding that there were a couple of Superfund sites in Houston or in the Houston area. Can you describe a little bit about the problems you encountered when the flooding occurred?
Yeah, what a challenge with the hurricanes that hit, and specifically San Jacinto, which is a site near I-10 in the harbor area there, has dioxin that's implanted, has been there for several years. It was listed by the EPA as a Superfund site 2010 timeframe, and for the last several years, our response, working with the responsible party to secure that site, has been to put rocks on top of a covering, if you will, heavy rocks to try to prevent the release of dioxin into the water supply. I went down there to look in mid-September after the hurricanes and saw that and thought, that's entirely unacceptable. We need a permanent solution. And I told them, Boyden, that we were going to make a decision by OU Texas. Now, OU Texas is a holiday. That football game occurs the second Saturday of October. It's an event. People in Texas knew what that meant. People in Oklahoma knew what that meant. People in D.C. did not. So when I got back to Washington, I said, now, they asked me, what did you say? And I said, we're going to make a decision by OU Texas. And they said, well, what does that mean? I said, October 14th. And so we had a decision made by October 12th to provide a permanent solution to that site, about $115 million. The two responsible parties are rather, they're barking at that, but they're the ones who put dioxin on the site. They should be held accountable. We're going to provide a permanent solution for the people of Houston to make sure that that dioxin does not get in the water supply. That's exactly the kind of role we should be playing.
The United States gets continually criticized for being like the international environmental scofflaw, which has always irritated me, because we have the cleanest air and the cleanest water probably in the world, and it's just it's something that the public ought to have a better better knowledge of. We've reduced greenhouse gases more in the last 10 or 15 years than any other region in the world, and do we get any credit for it? Does anyone know this? No. You're dealing now with the Clean Power Plan. You've rescinded it. You're going to propose something. I don't think I've probably got the right to demand that you tell us what you're going to do. But any light you could shed on this, to me, the larger picture of, you know, with European cities shutting down from traditional air pollution, and that hasn't happened in this country probably in, you know, almost 100 years. What's going on? Why can't we get the public straight on how in really good shape we are relatively, although, as you pointed out, there's still a great deal more to do?
Well, I appreciate the question, because I think it is not recognized. We're at pre-1994 levels today with respect to our CO2 footprint. And between the years 2000 and 2014, we reduced our CO2 footprint by over 18%. You know, so as a country, unlike others, we've been leading through action. We've been leading through innovation and technology. The CO2 reduction has largely occurred because of what? Innovation and technology, and not government mandate. And so that was what was wrong with Paris. Yeah, Paris was a bumper sticker. It was a label. It was not about reduction of CO2. If it was, China would not have been able to wait until 2030 to achieve CO2 reductions. India would not have been able to wait until 2030 and also condition their performance on $2.5 trillion of aid. Russia would not have been able, you know, to base their 1994 levels on emission reductions that actually allowed them to increase CO2. And so when you look at all that, this country, as Boyden indicated, we have nothing to be apologetic about with respect to our commitment through action, through innovation, through technology, and reducing CO2, while the rest of the world simply talks about it. And so the president showed tremendous fortitude, tremendous courage in making the decision to say, that's a bad business deal for this country. We need to recognize what we're doing, not be apologetic about it, and he took the appropriate steps to exit that very, very bad accord. Now, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't engage in the future, that we shouldn't, you know, that we shouldn't deal with our partners internationally, but Boyden, you're exactly right. When it comes to water quality and air quality, this country does it better than anybody in the world. We understand what it means to grow an economy and also be a good steward of our environment, and we should do that and celebrate that. In fact, there was a story several months ago, I can't remember the publication, ran an article called The Greatest Story Seldom Told. My staff can get it to you. If you reach out to my office, I'll get it to you. But it's a tremendous article about the progress we've made as a nation with respect to air quality and all these various issues, and very few people know the progress we've made because of the commitment of stakeholders, states, and the U.S. government working together to achieve these things.
I suppose you have.
Now, I didn't answer your question about CPP, did I?
No, you didn't. And maybe because you don't want to.
That wasn't intentional. I just got talking about other things. So, do you want me to?
Yes.
Do you want to do that, Boyden?
Yes.
Okay. So with respect to the Clean Power Plan, as you know, we're in a process of withdrawing the Clean Power Plan. And as Boyden indicated, in an unprecedented way, the U.S. Supreme Court issued a stay against that Clean Power Plan. And so, we are in that process, but there's also a second step that we're taking, much like WOTUS. We're going to be issuing an advance notice of proposed rulemaking very, very soon, and we're going to be soliciting comment and input from folks to ask and answer the question, what are the tools in the toolbox to address CO2 reduction under Section 111 of the Clean Air Act? And that's very important, because as you look at the Clean Power Plan, the past administration did with that plan much like they did WOTUS. They took terms in the statute, best system of emission reduction, and interpreted in ways that they had never interpreted it before. They actually took the best system of emission reduction and said that it gave them the authority to force, to coerce states across the country and utility companies to move from fossil fuel generation of electricity to generation generated by renewables. That's how they had determined what best system of emission reduction equaled. That's something, obviously, that created great uncertainty, great concern in the marketplace, and the courts intervened. What we're doing now is we're going to solicit input, comment from folks across the country and ask them, what do you think the tools are in the toolbox with respect to Section 111? And do it the right way. Rule of law is something that's not academic and just legal. It is very, very practical, because those across the country that operate under regulations, they want to ensure and they want to know that as they invest capital, allocate resources to comply with the regulation, that it's tethered to the statute, that there's not a disconnect. Because when you have a disconnect between a statute and a regulation, people step back and say, what am I supposed to do? The statute says one thing, the regulation says quite the opposite. And that means that investment doesn't occur. I'm so glad the US Congress is talking about tax cuts. I pray that they pass that soon. But I will tell you that one of the greatest impediments to our economic growth the last several years has been regulatory uncertainty. And our agency has been the poster child insofar as creating that uncertainty in the marketplace. So we're getting back to the basics of focusing on rule of law, asking the question, what does the section say we can do, and do that. And let me say this to you. We're not going to fill in the blank. We're not going to fill in the vacuum. We're not going to do the job of Congress if they don't tell us what to do in those sections. We're going to go back to Congress and say, if you want us to do more, do something novel. Amend the statute. Pass a law. Give us the authority. Give us the direction so we can actually act pursuant to your direction. That's what we should be doing as an agency. Every executive branch agency should be doing that. We shouldn't be filling in the space where Congress has failed to do its job.
Well, I think the example you can set there would really be a small revolution for the entire government. Congress has not lived up to its obligations to give you the proper instruction.
Well, the last time we amended the Clean Air Act, Boyden, you were doing it, right?
A long time ago.
27 years ago, right?
27 years ago.
It may need to be addressed.
Things have to have changed in 27 years, you'd think.
We have.
So you've stated your goals in general terms of rule of law and federalism. Could you maybe answer this question? What, and this may be too open a question, but what is the legacy that you would like to leave at EPA? What would you like the tombstone to read? That's maybe too short of a description.
I don't want to get there yet, Boyd. That's kind of dour.
But what is the legacy that you would like to leave?
Look, I think I made reference to this earlier. I mean, regulatory reform, what we're engaging in on CPP and WOTUS, and there's a host of others, by the way. We don't wake up each morning with we have things to do. We have enough to say grace over. But the regulatory reform aspect, as arduous as that is, navigating all those waters legally and otherwise, it's not really the most challenging thing that we encounter. The most challenging thing that we encounter, in my view, is, again, this thinking, this attitude that we as a country have to choose between growth and jobs and being good stewards of our environment. I mean, I've been asking the question lately, what is true environmentalism? I mean, what do you consider true environmentalism? And from my perspective, it's environmental stewardship, not prohibition. You know, we have been blessed as a country with tremendous natural resources. We know what those are. I believe that we have an obligation to feed the world, empower the world with a sensitivity as far as environmental stewardship for future generations. We need to cultivate and also be stewards of those resources so we can serve future generations as well. We can do both, but the past few years we've been told it's prohibition, it's put up a fence, it's do not touch. And frankly, I just don't think that's consistent with the law. I don't think it's consistent with the American, you know, what we've done, how we've done business as a country. And we need to reorient our thinking. We need to ask and answer the question, how do we find the balance? How do we work together to achieve stewardship and growth? Because I will tell you this, to whom much is given, much is required. And we've been blessed as a nation, and we need to recognize that we can feed the world, empower the world, and serve fellow mankind, and do it in a way that protects the environment and is a good steward of the environment. That's the greatest challenge we have, and we all ought to be asking that question as we go through the next several years.
Well, I think, unfortunately, our time is up, but you ended it at just the right note, and I can't think of anything else I want to ask you. No.
I don't buy that at all.
So why don't we all give Administrator Pruitt a round of applause.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.